Ah, mmm. The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
This is the Rehumanizing Project from Good Morning Liberty. My name is Nate Thurston from the Good Morning Liberty podcast. The co-host Charlie and I had a great conversation with a guy named Brandon Means, a libertarian who has some great ideas, a very interesting story, and as you guessed it, actually cares about other people. Please listen to Brandon's story, listen to his message, listen to the things that have happened to him throughout his life, the things he has gone through, and all of the events that have led to the beliefs that he has.
Born out west in California, Northern California, but at the time my dad had started computer software. At the time, he was recruited right out of college by, I think it was Xerox. They moved him to the East Coast, to Worcester, Massachusetts. So I was only in California for about 6 months. He got transferred about 8 years later down to just outside Atlanta. Gwinnett County, which is huge now. It was really backwoods at the time, but it's just blown up. Basically a big concrete jungle. Apart from that, you know, I did most of my growing up in Atlanta in the South, so I consider myself a, you know, from the South, which kind of drives my wife crazy because she's actually from Midwest, Minnesota. She spent a lot of time in Atlanta as well, but she really doesn't claim to be from the South. She prefers the Midwest. Grew up there, did all my schooling there, you know, went to public middle school, high school, all that. Was never a great student. I barely graduated just because I wasn't really interested. I'd rather, you know, play Nintendo and play baseball and football with the kids in the neighborhood and all that. So pretty limited coming out of high school. Didn't really have any college plans or anything. I did the least amount I could to get through high school. I was one of the kids you would find asleep in the back of the class. I didn't engage too much with, you know, apart from the few friends that I did have in the neighborhood. I just never really put forth any effort. I just didn't have the interest in the topics. I don't know. Well, you know, now that I think there were some classes I did engage in, certainly some of the math classes, you know, I got up into sort of like the higher algebra, you know, I didn't take any calculus or anything like that. But we did also have a computer science course that we were actually, my little group of friends were the first people to bring the AP computer science to my high school. We started that class. I did fairly well and I passed it at least. And I was engaged in, you know, writing code and things like that. I never went on to become a computer programmer, but you know, those were the kinds of topics I was interested in. So yeah, it's probably, you know, if we had more things like that, that probably would have drove me to do more.
Need something more challenging then.
Yeah.
I was the exact same way, but we went to a really small town. So high school was just our high school. Nate and I went to the same one. It was just easy. They didn't, there was no challenge. And I was the same way. There were a few classes like, you know, chemistry, because I like to do experiments and stuff like that. So that was fun. But other classes, yeah, I slept right through. I remember the only class that I really struggled in mostly was because they required reading. And at the time, I wasn't a big reader. And so I got a D in that class.
Yeah, I think that was also the time they were really pushing the idea of college prep for everybody. I don't think they had it for everybody, but certainly that was what they were pushing. There were still some vocational courses and things like that, wood shop and all, and I took a few of those and had fun in those courses. But no, it was definitely, you were going to college afterward, and if you weren't, then you were going to be a low class, you know, laborer You know, a lot of people are fine with that, and I certainly would have been. I did spend a lot of time in Scouts, though. That was something I was really interested in. Boy Scouts taught me a lot about taking care of personal interests, you know, being responsible, things like that. Even though I didn't really translate that into school or anything, you know, did a lot of camping with friends, had really tight-knit group. But after that, you know, joined the Air Force for 4 years because I didn't feel I had really had any other options. You know, wasn't interested in going to college and, you know, just had a high school job that I didn't really see going anywhere. So I figured that was a good option to at least get me out and have an income and a purpose. But that didn't end up becoming a career because, you know, ran into some trouble with drinking and a couple things like that. You know, they kind of frown on that when you get picked up by the police and for being drunk and all. So
I had an issue on a base one time where we were playing music on the base, but we were in the Middle East and they weren't allowed to have any alcohol there whatsoever. Needless to say, we were at a giant party one night and on the base ended up one of the soldiers was going to give us a ride back to where we were sleeping on the base because we didn't know where we were. And he got pulled over for going over the speed limit on the base and then ended up getting kicked out of the military the next day.
Yeah, that's so, pretty bad.
Yeah, I felt terrible about that.
Yeah, I don't know when that was. I think we were actually in sort of a contraction for the military at the time when I ran into trouble. Anyway, I don't know if that had been the same time you had your experience, but I think there was actually a drive to reduce the number of people, at least in my branch anyway. So I didn't do myself any favors by giving them an excuse to try and do that. But fortunately, I was able to stay in and got my honorable discharge at the end of my term. So
what is your political ideology and what parts of these things that you've gone through in your life and all these experiences do you think led up to having this ideology?
I am very much, I guess, a personal person. I really just like to keep things myself and not rely on other people because, you know, I always find out people don't ever really do things to my satisfaction or the way I want to do them. So I just don't like, you know, meddling, I guess, might be a good way to say it. So after I had all that experience in the Air Force and you know, I met some people who taught me about educating myself, you know, I really started to read and learn things on my own. That's where I finally became interested in maybe going to college. You know, back in high school, I had no intention, but after I sort of realized I can learn things and there are broader topics out there for me to learn, I started really trying to figure that out. When I did get home from the Air Force, you know, started going to school and realized I can do things for myself. Even, you know, after the Boy Scout experience, you know, doing things, trying to be a responsible leader and things like that, I really kind of was still looking for that comfort. Maybe that was maybe one of the reasons why I went into the Air Force as well, because I knew the military kind of, they told you what to do and where to go, and they kind of, you know, even though I could be responsible, I still had someone there giving me direction. And it was really after that I kind of realized that I wanted to find my own direction.
So you made the transition into libertarianism. When did that happen? Was that after the Air Force?
I got home. You know, I just started. I guess it was mostly on my drives to work and driving around town would throw on the talk radio. And actually, that was during one of the Clinton elections. No. It was one of the Bush elections. I heard a lot of conversation about, you know, Democrats stealing the election. It was the one that went to the Supreme Court, I think. So I started listening to talk radio. A guy named Neil Bortz was the morning host on one of the stations, and started listening to him. And he got me onto the conservative spectrum anyway. I didn't necessarily have a defined political leaning at that point, but at least not a conscious one. But he got me onto that, and so I figured I was a Republican, you know, conservative. And but it wasn't until he actually started, you know, dropping little leaks and hints about actual libertarianism, the idea of literal freedom, not just, you know, the conservative idea of freedom or the Republican idea of freedom, that I started, you know, looking at, what is that, Frederick Bastiat, the, wrote, what was it, The Law, I believe, and other.
Bastiat,
yeah. 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 And then just getting, learning about other, ideas of freedom. Can't think of any other, the, any of the other literature out there on that, but started reading that and taking, and, you know, actually reading the Constitution of the United States, right? How that was originally written and the ideas of limited government, which it actually defines in there. And, you know, actually talking about the rights that the government doesn't give you, but that you actually have, right? So, and it's kind of crazy, the idea that people think today that the government gives us these rights. It's not that they give us these rights, it's that these rights are already guaranteed, and the government should be there to protect them. So those kinds of ideas are the ones that really got me onto that train of thinking.
Yeah, that was one of the more important things I think I ever heard and realized, was that the Constitution didn't give anyone any rights. It simply recognized that human beings have these rights, and that the government is going to be formed, and they're going to make sure that no one takes those rights away from you.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't that the you know, people who wrote it sat down and said, you know what, we have this Constitution, but we also need to give people rights. What are those rights? It wasn't. No, it's I guess they saw that the government could grow into an entity that could start suppressing rights, and they needed to clearly define what rights people had that can't be suppressed.
Yeah, and right in the beginning of the Declaration of Independence, I mean, it just spells it out right there. And then it talks about to secure these rights. So it talks about having the rights to begin with, and then to secure them, that governments are instituted among men deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. But then right after that, Thomas Jefferson says that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it.
Yeah.
It's as plain as it could be.
One of the arguments I hear, too, is you talk about, you know, it's in the Declaration of Independence. One of the things I hear, and I don't know that I've ever followed up on, is that but people say, but the Declaration of Independence isn't actually law, right? So you can't call on that to justify any actions. I don't know. It might be in the federal code somewhere, but
I'm pretty sure it's the first federal code.
Yeah.
But it gives you, when you're trying to interpret what some of the Bill of Rights and what the Constitution means, looking back to something like, okay, well, let's this is what you think it means. Let's cross check that against this other document that these people wrote, you know, and let's just see, would they have meant that it's this, because they, you know, they created the country based on these little paragraphs right here. What's amazing is that this is all very short and easy to read, and you can sit down and read it. Well, easy to read in the sense that it's short. If you can get past all the Queen's English, then that's okay. But it's, the Constitution is very short. I love how short that, you know, article went.
Yeah.
I
mean, it's not horribly complex.
No, it's so great that something that simple could do so much. I mean, it's a paragraph or two for each thing.
Yeah. And it's an example that things don't have to be horribly complex in order to get your meaning across.
No, I mean, 2000 pages, for one idea is maybe we should have a two paragraphs. And if you can't sum it up in those two paragraphs, maybe you're trying to do way too much, you know?
Yeah.
It does say, to clarify here, it's considered declarationism. And that's a legal philosophy, and the Declaration of Independence is the body of case law on level with the United States Constitution, and it holds that the Declaration is a natural law document, and so that natural law has a place within American jurisprudence. It's prudence.
Interesting. I'd actually never heard that before.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yes. That's interesting. We have a natural law within American jurisprudence that allows for the people to alter or abolish its own government.
So after I got out of the Air Force, I started working for Barnes & Noble Booksellers. I was with them for 12 or 13 years. And one of the things I learned about retail is it just attracts everybody. It's usually, you know, a means to get to some other end, but just about everybody from every walk of life comes into retail at some point. So, you know, the people I work with became the people I hung out with. You know, after a shift, we'd go out to the bar, have some drinks, and just get to know each other. A lot of us were going to school, but some of us were older, you know, in our 40s and had just made retail, you know, their career, which is great. A lot of great people. But it was just every sort of walk of life, you know, liberals, conservatives, gay people. I knew a transgender person, you know, it was just all walks of life came together just to have an income, have, you know, bring in some money. And when we all got to know each other and had a good time. And so we didn't, you know, necessarily get into a lot of debates, but we certainly all had our own political leanings and philosophies, and we would talk about them. And I never, pushed too hard because it always seems I was on the, you know, oppressive end of this, of these ideas, you know, being a male and straight and white, and you know, even though you like a lot, most people, I don't think I ever had a whole lot of money growing up, but we certainly weren't poor. I think we were right smack in the middle of the middle class, which has a lot of privilege. So I tended to keep my mouth shut. I never really, you know, got in depth with my ideas. I always held back. Well, not always. I think people knew I was for personal responsibility and freedom. And I never, you know, endorsed taxation and things like that. But, no, it was always good. I always just tried to, you know, let people live their own lives. And I never really tried to push my own agenda. Maybe I could have and converted a few more people to the ideas of freedom and liberty, but, yeah, we all just enjoyed our own company. Never made it too serious.
And you never really saw those people as your enemy, did you?
No, certainly not. You know, like I said, we were all just, you know, it all came from working at the bookstore. We were all just trying to make a living. And I don't know if it would, you know, would have made things, you know, more difficult to work with each other or what, but no, we all just got along, had good times. You know, it was always not a party, but you know, it was, yeah, we just enjoyed each other's company. We never had too much serious disagreement.
Do you see a stark difference between then versus now?
Yeah, I don't know. I want to say it wouldn't be terribly different. Maybe it would. Can only, I guess, compare, you know, the environment I'm in now. You know, I still have a fairly diverse group of people around me. You know, there are a couple people at my current job, you know, I'm not super close with any of these people, you know, I don't really have the friendship circle maybe that I had before. You know, now it's all about my wife and daughters and all that. But the people at work, they do all get along. There are some diverse opinions in there. There are some people who are more politically active. It's mostly, I'd say, left-leaning, but there are certainly some conservative people. I doubt there's anyone who's, you know, as for libertarianism as I am. But
did you have a different work ethic than a lot of the people that you worked with?
One of the things that I've learned is actually not to compare people to myself. But, you know, there are certainly good workers and bad workers, and everybody has good days and bad. But I try not to, I know everybody comes from a different background, so I try not to compare everybody else's work ethic to mine. You know, I have lazy days too. I did learn to, at the very least, put forth your best effort. And there are a lot of people that, particularly where I am now, that don't put forth that effort. Part of it has to do with they're unionized and they have a guaranteed salary. And there's, you know, seniority. And so people, they know that whether they do their job or not, they're still going to get paid. And it's one of those situations where, you know, it's fairly difficult to get rid of someone. But I'm not part of the union, so I still put forth my best effort. And I got to say, even if I was, you know, I always feel I'd be one of those people that we really do value at work, you know, the ones you can always rely on putting forth their best effort. And you ask them to do, you know, something extra beyond their defined duties, you know, they'll go ahead and do it and try to give you their best.
Hey, is there a specific story? Did something specifically affect you in your life and what you wanted to do that kind of led you to libertarianism? Or was it just an ongoing search for knowledge and the truth that kind of led you to where you are now?
It was more the just the philosophical idea, I think. It might be more the idea that I found it strange that people, I think, would treat politics more as entertainment. This was also fairly close to the beginning of, 24-hour news coverage, where you could devote an entire TV channel to saying the same thing over and over and over and over. And there was a particular person I worked with who was very left-leaning during one of the elections. You know, she knew I was... I don't think she ever realized I was totally libertarian, because she always assumed I was voting for the Republican, and she would come in and she's like, "Oh, do you hear what your guy said the other day?" I'm like, "Wait a minute, he's not my guy. I don't like this guy as much as I like your guy."
Right.
So I'm voting for the libertarian candidate. I don't remember who that was at the time, but it was those kinds of things. You know, it's just I couldn't really believe that there was so much entertainment value to politics, which was, you know, as far as I was concerned, a very serious thing. And people seemed to take it lightly, but they didn't. I don't think they realized, you know, what they were doing to the whole political spectrum. And it probably always has been a popularity contest, you know, even back before 24-hour news coverage. You know, people read their physical newspaper every day and read stories on that. But I think I realized that was possibly what's hurting us more than anything else, is we probably don't take it as seriously as we should and treat it more as a popularity contest, who can have more entertaining digs at the other person, that kind of thing.
What would you say to someone to explain to them why we should take it more seriously?
Because it is oppression, really. You know, it's, whatever agenda your party wants to push or you want to push, right now, everything seems to be taking rights and liberties away from people to give it to other people. And eventually, you know, it does lead to complete oppression. And it seems like, you know, we are going that way. Even I'd say 10, 15 years ago, it would be, you know, crazy to think that we could end up living in a completely socialist society, but, you know, 10 to 15, 30 years from now, it could end up being that way. And, you know, neither Democrat or Republican is really trying to steer us away from that direction.
Some people, when you say, well, we're going to end up living in the socialist society, there's a lot of people that are like, yeah, okay, awesome. And,
yeah.
And it, you know, when we think about that, we think about Venezuela and Russia and China and all, you know, we'll think about Pol Pot and we'll think about all this stuff. But everyone else, it seems like when you mention going to a socialist society, what we found is everyone thinks that as long as we put the right person in control and we have the perfect people in control of the government, that we're not going to be like that. That Russia was like that because Stalin was so bad, and China was like that because Mao was a terrible person, and you know, Pol Pot, he was just an evil, murderous person, and you know, Chavez was okay, but Maduro, he's an evil dictator, and so it seems like everyone thinks that as long as they're in control of the socialist regime, everything's gonna be fine, right?
And it probably would be great for them, but I think what people also don't realize is there is almost a literal 50-50 split down the middle of ideas in this country. And you're always going to be, or one side is always going to be oppressing the other side. And you're never going to have anywhere close to a complete agreement on everything, which is really what you know, that socialist society forces on people is this is what we believe, and you believe it or we jail you or kill you or whatever. It's always going to swing one direction to the other, right? I mean, it seems like every 4-8 years it goes to the other side. And so no matter what we enact, no matter what we force on people, it's the other person's always going to be in charge somewhere down the line.
And would you say you're a libertarian because you're selfish and you want things for yourself, or is it because you want, you know, the, you want both, because you talked about it being split basically down the middle, which is true. Or do you want both of those sides to be able to have, you know, their own ideology and the liberty to practice what they believe without opposing their beliefs on the other side?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say, you know, I am a selfish person. You know, I go to work because I want the, you know, I want to have money to buy things for my family and buy my own food and buy my own shelter. You know, it goes beyond those basic needs, but you know, I want everybody to have the opportunity to do that for themselves. And if you need some assistance, you know, you'll be able to find it. Just have to know where to go or have that, you know, local charity or church. You know, we belong to a church and everyone at that church would be more than happy to help us if we needed a hand. And I think we actually have gotten some help. You know, when we first got together, my wife and I didn't have the most money in the world. But, you know, you don't have to belong to a church. It's just whatever community you live in, there's people willing to help.
I liked your answer to it, which is that you think that makes you do you want libertarianism because you're just a selfish person? And I think when people think that, they think in the evil form of selfishness. And you're talking
greedy.
You're talking more in the Ayn Rand version of selfishness, which is that we are all selfish, and we do want what is best for us. But you also you don't want to see anyone starving in the streets, and you want people to be able to have health care and everything, right?
Like, yeah, no, I did have someone tell me once, it wasn't because I did kind of get onto a political conversation, which I never do, really. I always try to avoid those. But he brought up the idea that he doesn't mind, you know, corporations out there, but what really drives him crazy is when people say, oh, I have all this money and you can't have any. You know, I don't want taxation because I don't want you to have my money. I was like, well, okay, that's I don't know where to go with that. I'm certainly not that way. You know, I don't mind helping people. I just, you know, would rather help the people I want to help and not be forced to help other people that you know, aren't really in my life, or I have no idea who they are or what they're doing or whatever. You know, I just kind of want control over my own money, right? Give it to people who I deal with on a day-to-day basis.
You think libertarians have done a bad job marketing that idea? Like, it's something we've tried to not talk about, which is, I mean, we'll all say taxation is theft, and that's obviously something that we like saying, but I try to not go along the lines of, this is mine, you can't have it, stop trying to take what's mine, I want it, it's mine. And it's not because that isn't true, but from the time that we're little kids, we're taught that that's a really bad idea to have about things. And so we try to talk more along the lines of, it's better for everyone if everyone gets to keep what is theirs, and then everyone will work towards gaining things that are theirs. And maybe if I gain more, I'm going to take care of my mom and my friends and my family members and my community and all of that. And then also there's going to be other people inside of every single community that will be able to mm-hmm. do that. So like when you say, I want to be able to help the people that I know or that are close to me, if I were like a leftist, I would say, well, you just don't care about people other than the people that are close to you. But there's a whole world out there and there's billions of people and you only care about these people and you don't care about the livelihoods of anyone else. I think that's a bit of a marketing problem on libertarianism.
Yeah, it's a hard concept to get across that you care about somebody, but you're not, you know, willing to donate your own money to their cause because you're just trying to help your own situation. That's a hard idea to cross, to get across that you really do care about people, but you're not willing to help them. It does sound kind of bad that you're not willing to help people who are in need.
If you're on a plane with someone that you care about and you lose cabin pressure, you don't care about them by making sure that they get their mask on first, because then you might be dead. And so the best thing to do is to get your mask on first, mm-hmm. which I think is what we're all trying to do, is to get our mask on so we can help other people.
And that's, you know, one of the big problems, you know, with libertarians, you know, running for president when they're asked about like foreign aid, you know, they want to cut foreign aid. Well, you know, it's because we have so many issues here ourselves with, you know, our own social problems, from homelessness to drug addiction and everything like that. We can certainly, you know, put our own money to good use right here. And it's not that we don't care about, you know, people in other countries starving, but, you know, we have such a hole here ourselves to fill. It's hard to, I think, justify, you know, all that money, the, you know, billions of dollars, you know, going elsewhere to help other people. Governments that aren't adaptable are doomed to fail, because governments that don't change with time don't change with people, because people change. You know, we change at an ever increasing rate, you know, with our technology and things like that. You know, one of the things we always talk about is, you know, the founders couldn't have ever dreamed of the internet, you know, and information traveling so quickly throughout the entire world. But that's the point, you know, they couldn't predict that. So they tried to set up a government that could change. You know, they gave us a way to change our constitution, which we've done several times. So it's adaptability, you know. As I said, I'm not an anarchist. I'm not, you know, I do appreciate having a government, to settle disputes, to, you know, give us general guidelines for health and safety, you know, help us with sanitation. You know, a lot of those things can be privatized, and are in many places. But, you know, having a government is a good thing. But it just needs to not be so rigid and not, you know, be so forceful. It needs to be able to change over time.
Do you think that's more an argument for subjective idea of what a government can do, or more an argument for more local governance, because they can change with the people more
easily? I think
easily?
Certainly more local governance, because, you know, people in North Dakota have different needs than people in South Georgia. Actually, those are two pretty remote areas, so they actually might be fairly similar. But, you know, certainly people, you know, certainly people in, you know, inner cities have different needs than people in rural areas. So they don't need the, you know, the federal government to come in and say, you know, we have to have.
There's not a one size fits all solution for, yeah.
No, there's not. And
I think the founders understood that. That,
yes,
that's why they set up the government, why they did. And really, the federal government was supposed to be a list of enumerated powers. It was the things that made the separate sovereign states stronger together, like a military or settling, you know, foreign commerce or treaties or different things like that. Mm-hmm. And in that time, I mean, they needed a king, so to speak, right, to be a foreign diplomat. And to have, let's say, power and the person on the world stage. But they were very specific in saying the federal government is only for these specific things. And, you know, North Carolina can do what North Carolina wants to do, and Virginia can do what Virginia wants to do. But we need to come together on these very specific things. And then from there, it's just, you know, ballooned into all these things.
I think the founders were more libertarian than they are, say, Republicans these days. Republicans,
certainly, yeah, because you know, most of them were, you know, sort of businessmen, you know, looking to skirt oppressive taxation, right, and found it terribly oppressive. So yeah, I think they were looking for a lot less government, or a lot less tyranny anyway. Are those things the same? Yeah, no, I certainly think they were far more libertarian than people give them credit for. And if you really wanted to, you know, use them to support your own ideas, then you have to realize that they probably wouldn't have supported your ideas. You know, if you're certainly trying to, introduce more government and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I feel like the Republican Party is kind of skewed from, is a, basically just paying lip service to the Constitution all the time and the Founding Fathers, without realizing that if Thomas Jefferson came back, he would take care of all the Republicans too. And I'm not saying that that's what should be done. I'm just saying, certainly not. That's I don't think he would. Although he would find him as non-oppressive.
Although I do think he said it was our duty to do that.
He did say it's a duty. I'm saying what he might do.
Right.
The point of this podcast is to point out the fact that we're all human beings who've had our different life experiences, and that even though we have different ideologies, more than likely people on the left don't want 100 million people to starve to death, mm-hmm. and more than likely people who are libertarians don't want everyone who is poor to starve and be homeless and not have health care. And so if you're talking to someone who's on the left, what would you tell them to make them not want to burn down their your house when they're going down the line? What should they know about you and your philosophy so that would get them to not want to do that?
I don't know. It sounds like they're pretty crazy and and wouldn't listen to me anyway, but
yeah.
They even attacked Rand Paul about Breonna Taylor when he's the one that introduced the Breonna Taylor Act.
I don't know. It's just personal freedom to be who are. You know, that's what we support the most, is just libertarianism and personal responsibility is the best way for everyone to supply their own needs. You know, it's the best way for you to find your own job, your best way to make your own money, your best way to find charity. It's the personal responsibility. It's scary not having the safety net sometimes, but you know, I think people will find, if your government isn't, you know, taking away your stuff and your money, then it's there for you to provide for your family and those around you and your communities. And when you do have a surplus, you can help people farther away from you. You can help people in the next town, in the next state. You can send money overseas if that's your thing. But to supply your own income and security is, you know how to take care of yourself. You have to have the freedom to do it. That rehumanizing is a big, big thing too. The thing we do these days in the media, social media, which I avoid, but is we do dehumanize people. We don't take people seriously. We don't realize that when somebody says something, tells you their ideas, they really mean it. They believe it, and they don't just, and that idea didn't just come to them. They came to that idea through their growing up, through who their parents were, through their social circles. They came to that idea legitimately. Whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, it doesn't really matter. They believe it, and we need to approach people at that point and realize that they're not just going to change their idea because we tell them it's stupid.
Yeah, I mean, they have that idea, and they think, you know, they're trying to think along the same lines. How can I help all of these people, or how can I make society the most prosperous for the most amount of people? And they've landed through all of their experiences on this being the solution to that problem. Mm-hmm. And they probably put a little bit of thought into it, maybe not enough, but they probably put a little bit of thought into it. We run a website called BernieLies.com. And even when we talk about Bernie, I've said several times, I don't think Bernie wants 100 million people to starve to death in a famine. Like, I don't think that's his goal. We can say, maybe if you're on the right wing, you can say he's a vicious communist who wants to kill 100 million people. I think that's ridiculous. I don't think that's what it is. I think he truly thinks this is the best way to help the most amount of people. And even though I see him extremely misguided in his hatred for people at mm-hmm. the top or whatever, he truly believes it for a reason. And what I want to get across is people who follow him or follow AOC or whoever, they do truly believe that for some reason. So I don't want to go harm them in some kind of a way, because you're just a sum of all the things that have happened to you in your life.
Right.
And so we are too. And so what I would like to get across is neither one of us should want to kill each other.
No.
Right now. You guys enjoyed this episode of the Rehumanizing Project from Good Morning Liberty. Please hit subscribe. There will be a new episode every Sunday when we want to. And of course, please join our Patreon at patreon.com/goodmorningliberty. You can get this episode on Friday instead of Sunday and join our podcast live every single day of the week. Until next time, have a good day and a good morning, Liberty.